This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about the process that new medicines go through on the way from discovery to their approval for use. On average, it takes something like a dozen years to bring a new prescription drug to the market, and it costs hundreds, literally hundreds of millions of dollars. Some people, when they look at this process, complain that it takes too long and that it's too complicated, and what it does, the result, is that it keeps promising new medicines out of the hands of people who need them. Other people look at the process and say it's really too lax, and as a result, drugs can come to the market that are later found to be hazardous. We'll talk a little bit about how we perhaps steer the course between those two points, talk a little bit about the process for drug approval, and perhaps talk about a number of things too, including how it is that we decide whether or not people should have access to experimental medications. And our guest for the program is Francis Palumbo. He is professor and also executive director at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy's Center on Drugs and Public Policy, based in Baltimore in Maryland. He is both a licensed pharmacist and also a member of the Maryland Bar and has practiced both pharmacy and law. He is interested in a number of issues that have to do with prescription drugs, including pharmacy law and economics. He's also very much interested in the FDA and drug regulation. He has served as president of the Academy of Pharmaceutical Research and Science, and also the American Society for Pharmacy Law, where he serves on the board of directors. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers, people who are wanting to join the conversation, the only thing we ask is people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and try to keep our program moving along. But anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to call 333-9455. That is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455. Again, for the local audience here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Palumbo, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. There are a number of different things that I was hoping that we could talk about, but I thought perhaps it would be a good idea just here at the start if you could give us the thumbnail sketch of the vetting process for a new drug, for something that a pharmaceutical company has developed, something they think it has promise. What basically does the company have to do? What's the process look like for them to get to the point where this drug can be approved for use?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to do so. Well, I think the first thing is that they do have to do a substantial amount of what we call preclinical studies. That is, they have to look at this in the laboratory, then they have to introduce it into various species of animals to see how it reacts with the tissues and the other organ systems of the animals, and to determine whether it might be effective in this particular condition that they're trying to research, and whether it's probably going to be safe. And they do a substantial number of these studies before they decide that they're ready to introduce it into human beings for the very first time. And, of course, that's a big jump, going from animal species into a human, because, of course, we don't know what the effect is going to be, since no one's ever presumably taken this before. They need to go at that point to the FDA and request permission to conduct their clinical trials. And basically, those trials are conducted in three phases. The first phase involves looking just at the safety, basically, of the compound. So they'll introduce this into a small number of healthy human volunteers. And they want to use healthy people because if there's going to be a problem with the drug, if there's a side effect, an untoward reaction of some sort. They want to have a high degree of confidence that the side effect is due to the drug and not to some other drug that they're taking or some underlying medical condition that they might have. Now, they only use about 20 to 40 patients for these phase one studies, so they are rather small. And of course, they're volunteers, and they must get informed consent from these patients or their representatives if they happen to be, some children sometimes, or perhaps they're elderly, or perhaps they're unable for mental reasons to be able to give consent for themselves. So someone, a responsible party, must do that, and so that they have all the protections in place for the subject, i.e., the person who's in the study. Let's say that the study is favorable. At that point, they will then ask the FDA if they can move it to the next phase, which is called phase two. In phase two, we're starting to look for some evidence of effectiveness. Now, throughout this whole process, we never stop looking at safety, because safety is a major issue with any drug. So now we've got human volunteers again with informed consent and so forth, and maybe 200 or 300 people at this point. And these folks are going to presumably have the illness that we're trying to treat with this new drug. Let's just, for the sake of argument, say it's hypertension. So all 200 or 300 people would have hypertension, and then they would be enrolled in the study and tried on this new drug. So once this is over, if the drug is showing some effectiveness, and also they'll test it to see how it gets distributed in the bloodstream over time, the kinetics of the drug, and try to come up with a reasonable dosage for the product. Once they've finished all that, they then move into phase three. Now, phase three is the big study, and that can involve several thousand people. And, of course, once again, we're still looking at safety, but now we're really looking at what the FDA calls substantial evidence of effectiveness. And by substantial evidence, they mean well-controlled clinical trials. So we've got these folks now enrolled in this phase three. What they're taking is the dosage form that the company hopes to bring to the market. Let's say it's a coated tablet or something like that. And then this is studied. And after the results are in, the company compiles all of the information, the phase one, phase two, phase three, all the preclinical, all other laboratory information, manufacturing processes, the labeling, all of that goes into one huge package, which is called the New Drug Application, and is then sent to the Food and Drug Administration. And the FDA then will, at some point, rule on that Food and Drug on that New Drug Application. And, of course, if they have a favorable outcome, the company is then granted a license by the federal government to market the drug in interstate commerce. So that's a thumbnail sketch.
All right. And in round figures, if you talk about the time it takes to get from your beginning of phase one to approval, on average, our one figure that I came across was 12 years. Is that still about right?
That's ballpark. There's no exact number. There's no real average that would be meaningful, but 12, I'd say 9 to 12 years is probably about what we're talking about from day one.
And at the point where they have completed all three phases, they have made this application to the FDA,
right.
And at that point, then when the FDA reviews this all and the FDA approves, mm-hmm. and the manufacturer is licensed to start to manufacture and to sell the drug, mm-hmm. at that point, though, only perhaps a few thousand people have taken it?
That is correct. That's absolutely correct. And of course, that's one of the criticisms of the system, that only a few thousand people have taken it, and yet within a year after the drug comes out on the market, well over 1 million people might have taken the drug.
I guess that's the point, and I'm not necessarily meaning this to be a criticism of the system, but it is indeed the kind of thing, the kind of question that people raise, is that even after a drug is approved, there is going to be a period of time when, in effect, we're still experimenting, because the number of people, until you get to that point within a year where you might have as many as a million people taking it, that it is still possible that we might see some problem develop, because previous to that, relatively speaking, a small number of people had taken the medication.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. In fact, that's often where a lot of the problems do come out during that first year, especially, and even after that, actually, you know, sometimes it takes years for the problems to come out. But if you look at the first year of exposure, the probability of finding a serious adverse event is going to be a lot higher in that first year than in subsequent years. And you think about it: let's say a really serious adverse event is going to occur once in every 10,000 patients. Well, if you've only studied it in 3,000 before it comes out on the market, you might miss it completely in the clinical trials. So it won't show up until later. More likely it's going to be something like, especially if it's unfortunately a death, you know, it might be 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 200,000, and those are so hard to pick up sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I think that another question or criticism that I'm sure that people would raise is that it is the manufacturer of the drug, the company that is proposing to manufacture and sell this, that is tasked with demonstrating safety and effectiveness. So, and they are hardly a disinterested party. How concerned should one be the fact that that they indeed have an interest in seeing the trials go well, and that perhaps it would be better before the point that the FDA comes and reviews all of the studies that have been done, it would be better to have someone who essentially has no interest in the outcome to be involved in the process of deciding, is this a good medicine? Is it both safe and effective?
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking if the company should bring in a disinterested party?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of that I suppose that in a sense that's the role of the FDA, to be the disinterested party, except that they're coming into the process once the work has already been done, and they're relying on the manufacturer to give them everything that they have and to give them a complete and objective account of what they've been doing.
I think I see where you're going. Okay. Actually, when you think about it, if we've got two interested parties, we've got the company on one side who wants to get their drug to market, and I'm not suggesting that they're going to cut corners, but of course they're interested in getting their drug to market. On the other side, we have the FDA, who's an interested party because they are tasked with the protection of the public health. And so they both got interests. And I think the way we deal with that in the U.S. is that the FDA uses advisory committees to help them make the decisions, so that when a new drug application is up for consideration, the FDA submits all the information to an advisory committee, which is made up in part of some folks within the FDA, but largely people outside the government, people in academe. There may be some people from industry on the panel, people from the other private sectors, foundations, organizations, consulting firms, and things of that nature. So it all people who have expertise in this scientific area and are qualified to render an opinion. And they review all this information, and they meet at FDA, and they issue an opinion, an advisory opinion to the Food and Drug Administration. FDA, by law, is not bound to follow their recommendation, but it usually does.
Mm-hmm.
Not always.
And is it possible to say at any one time, how many different medications are somewhere in this process, somewhere between phase one and phase three?
I'm sure those data are available, but I really don't know the number.
How about it? Say something like the percentage of medications that start along the road and that somewhere along the way it gets derailed because either they determine, well, maybe it's not as safe as we thought, or maybe it's not as effective, or maybe once we get past a few hundred people taking it to a few thousand, we have some sort of problem. So medications that are abandoned somewhere along the way.
Most of them, first of all, is a high percentage of abandonment. There is no number that's reliable that I am aware of, because companies don't have to provide that type of information. But from everything that I understand, there's a very high percentage of abandonments. Most of those take place, though, early in the process, before they actually even do any studies on human beings. Once they get into clinical trials, there's a higher degree of confidence on the part of the company that the drug is going to be something they can bring to the market. At that point, of course, there are still abandonments of products, because maybe in phase one they find that it's not as safe as they thought it would be. And I think as they move up the ladder, the probability of abandoning the product actually goes down, because they're establishing a baseline. For phase one, they've established that it seems like it's safe. Phase two, they're establishing that it still seems like it's safe and it appears to be effective. And so when they go into phase three, they've got a pretty high level of confidence that their clinical trials are going to prove them correct. And their clinical trials don't have to show that they're better than everything that's on the market. You know, they just have to show that it's effective. So you could have the sixth drug in a class come out and be just as effective as the other five, and no more effective, and it still could be approved.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Francis Palumbo. He's the executive director of the Center on Drugs and Public Policy, based at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. That's in Baltimore. He's both a licensed pharmacist and a member of the Maryland Bar, and has practiced both pharmacy and law, and among other things is interested in the law and economics of the pharmaceutical business, and also in the FDA and in drug regulation. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a little bit about the fact that in this process there are at least two interested parties. One would be the manufacturer, who would like to have a product to bring to market. One would be the FDA, that is interested in making sure that these medicines are both safe and effective before they're put onto the market. There are other groups of interested parties. There would be people with the condition that would be treated, who would be interested perhaps in new medicines that would help them. And then there would be those people who are concerned about making sure that medicines that are approved are indeed safe. And I'm sure that for both of those groups, there are people who on the one hand say the process takes too long, and there are people who would on the other side argue that, well, actually it should somehow be more thorough so that we could go further to make sure that drugs are not approved that then later we realize are problematic. Mm. If you take a look at the process as it is, and the fact that, yes, we do have these two concerns. One is we want to make sure that they're safe. The other is if they work and they are effective, we want them to be available for people. Do you think that the system as it is represents a reasonable compromise, a reasonable mid-course between those two concerns? That is, the one of wanting to make sure that they're safe, and the other is wanting to make sure that in a reasonable amount of time, if we have something that's promising, it is available for people to use.
Yeah, I think it does. Of course, you know, it's always subject to criticism, but there are a lot of factors that come into play here. For example, one of them is the expense that it takes to bring a new drug to market. Latest figures, which are now a couple of years old out of Tufts University, would indicate that it costs about $800 million to bring a new drug to the market from the laboratory. And so a company has put in a substantial investment of money to get this product onto the market. And my guess is it's probably over $1 billion at this point. So there comes a point where they need to start to gain some gain some gain on the amount of money that they have invested. There's also the patent issue. You know, while they're doing this work, their patent clock is ticking away, and every day that the product is not on the market is a day they've lost of their patent time. So there is that pressure to get it out on the market to maximize the amount of time you can have that product patent protected out on the market. So those are some of the real factors that come into play here. The other side of the coin is that it has been looked at in several thousand patients before it's put out onto the market, that if there were problems with it, at least in those several thousand patients, they would have emerged, that the data are looked at very, very carefully by the FDA before they approve a new drug application. There's a lot of back and forth between the FDA and the sponsor. It's not a question of just sending the application in and then sitting back and waiting and getting a yes, no answer. There's a lot of back and forth. So I think the process represents a reasonable compromise. I mean, if we kept drugs off the market for an interminable period of time, then people would not have the advantage of being able to use them when they need them, especially drugs for serious or life-threatening illnesses. I think those are the ones that really cry out for some expediency.
Just, again, this might be a difficult question to answer in brief, but if you look at the process for approving drugs that we use here in the United States, mm-hmm. and then look at the process as it exists in elsewhere, in Europe, in Japan, elsewhere in the industrialized world, is the process that we follow here in the United States essentially the same? Close enough so that we could say that essentially it's the same as the process for other countries?
Yes, more or less, although in some countries it takes a lot more time for a drug to get on the market than it does in the U.S. In other countries, less time. So I think we're maybe right around the middle of the road on that. Mm-hmm. We're certainly not on either end of the scale. But I think that the process is basically the same, you know, clinical trials and see how the drug reacts in patients under study before they're released for the market.
And though if there's a medication that has been approved, let us say it's a medication that's been approved for use in Europe, mm-hmm. and that company wants to market the drug in the United States, do they then have to go through the entire process again to get FDA approval for something that has already been approved?
They will have to go through clinical trials. That's a good question. They have to demonstrate to our Food and Drug Administration the drug is both safe and effective. Now, they may not have to go through phase one and phase two. They'll have to work it out with the FDA. What's the drug? How long has it been on the market? And what is the FDA going to require for them to get the drug approved in the U.S.? They are going to have to do clinical trials, though, to be able to show substantial evidence. They may use clinical trials that were done in other countries. The FDA, under the regulations, can allow those trials to be applied to their new drug application in the United States. So they can actually use those. I think there's an exception for things like antibiotics because people across the world have different flora in their intestinal tracts, and so antibiotics are going to act somewhat differently depending on where you live. So for those, they would be more likely require the trials be done here in the U.S. But for most drugs, they'll accept foreign clinical trials. Now, they have to come from a country where our FDA feels that other country has their own version of the FDA that's sufficient to oversee the trials in that country.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, starting with someone in Champaign, and that would be line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your taking my question. Mm-hmm. I appreciate also the fact that putting a new drug on the market is extremely expensive, as you said, upwards of $1 billion. And yet my question is the cost of medications for patients then becomes so high that we develop a differentiation between those who can afford them and those who cannot. My husband's currently on an antibiotic that, even with our copay was $40 for a 14-day supply, one pill per day. So that's like $24 per pill without the insurance coverage. And I'm wondering whether this is putting many of our population at odds with the system in that they aren't able to utilize these wonderful new drugs which are being produced. And so I'm going to hang up and let you comment on that. Thank you very much.
Sure. Right,
thank you.
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. I think the price of drugs is one of the major issues that we have in the United States. They are very expensive to produce, and then they're very expensive at the consumer level. I think that one of the things that we need to understand in the United States is that even with our great healthcare system, with Medicare Part D that just came into effect, with Medicaid for the very poor, for other assistance programs and so forth, and insurance programs for most people, that we still have over 40 million Americans in the United States who do not have access to health insurance, and therefore have a terrible time affording any health care, especially their drugs, and especially if they have chronic conditions that require them to take these drugs over a very long period of time. There are a number of programs to try to help these people, but they're not necessarily price reduction programs. They're maybe, at the manufacturer's level, but there's state programs for what we call pharmacy assistance. For people who are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid but fall below a certain income level, so they qualify for this state program. And about 35 or 40 states now have such a program, but you still have to be pretty low on income scale to be able to qualify for that. Then we have programs that are offered by the pharmaceutical companies themselves that a lot of people just really don't know about. Most of the brand name companies, because these are for brand name drugs, will provide their drugs to patients for free. And generally it requires, they all have different requirements for providing their drugs, but basically it requires that the patient's physician attest to the company that the patient cannot afford their medications. And then the company will provide those drugs for free. And I think a lot of folks just don't realize that those types of programs are available. So there are some stopgap things in here, but yes, the price is high. The companies argue that they have to charge these prices because of the research and development that they have to do to try to keep coming up with new products all the time. And you know, they're huge enterprises that just have to be fed constantly.
Well, this gets at this question, and you don't have to spend very much time talking about the cost of health care in the United States before you get around to talking about the cost of prescription medications,
right.
Which is considerable. And as you say, that people who study this and the industry, I'm sure they would say, look, it takes a lot of money to bring a new drug to the market. And there are many where we start out that maybe we think that have some promise and we invest in that. And somewhere along the line, we decide, no, that was a dead end. So it can be a very expensive business. And then on the other hand, there are people who look, though, at these companies, and they're very big companies and they have enormous sales and they make a lot of money. And they say, can we actually ask this question, how much profit is too much? And can we look at the amount of money that these companies make and say to them, yes, we recognize that you're entitled to a profit and that it costs a lot of money to bring a drug to the market, but it's our feeling that you're making too much money. Can you actually make a judgment like that?
Well, I think that certainly that's been one of the criticisms of the companies within, especially in the United States, especially when one looks to other countries and sees our drugs, quote-unquote, being sold in those other countries at lower prices. And that seems to be the main thing that really rubs Americans the wrong way about the pharmaceutical industry, is that they can go to Canada, they can go to France or Germany and buy, or Italy or Spain and buy drugs that are produced by American companies at a lower price than they can buy them here at home. And I think that trying to explain that to people is is not easy. And in fact, sometimes you can't come up with a good explanation as to why that is the case. But one reason why that is the case is because a lot of these other countries have price controls, that the country itself will only pay, it's usually a question where the country is paying, the government is paying for most of the drugs. And they will only pay so much. And they basically say to the company, well, you know, this is as much as we'll pay for your drug. So if you want to market your drug here, you have to market it at no more than this particular price. And so that's what keeps drugs less expensive in some of those developed countries, if you will. And we get to third world countries where people just flat out can't afford their medicines, and those are provided at you know, next to nothing by many companies, because I'm just making this up, but if a Lipitor tablet costs $1 a day, and you only make 50 cents a day for your whole family, you obviously can't afford $1 a day for a Lipitor tablet. So the prices often in those countries reflect that. And so, I think that some of the world is subsidizing other parts of the world.
The next caller here is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning. I thank you so much for starting the program by delineating the stages, because I think we're all on the same page now. My question relates to the use or the applicability of a medication for a second condition after it's been out and approved for its use for the first condition.
Right.
And what process does the company then have to go through for that?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. First of all, that's what we call off-label use of a drug.
Uh-huh.
And when a drug goes through the process of getting approved, the FDA generally will allow it to only go through for one indication at a time.
Yes.
So if the company wants to market the drug for a second indication, it actually has to do clinical trials to demonstrate the effectiveness of that drug in that second condition. However, if it doesn't do that, doctors are still free to prescribe it for that condition without violating the law.
Oh.
The law just does not allow the company to market it in any way for that off-label use.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance companies will generally pay for off-label use of drugs, although I think they're starting to look at this, especially with really high-cost specialty pharmaceuticals. But for the most part, the company can just have one indication that's approved, and their drug could be used for a lot of other indications, and it's perfectly legal as long as that company does not in any way
market
or otherwise promote its
drug.
Okay,
now let me ask you, have you covered the situation in which a medication, the patent goes out, and the company has seen that this was coming, and they said, aha, well, we can market it for something else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wouldn't be off-label, would it? I mean, if they actually actively market it, and how do they do that then?
Well, yes, I've seen that, of course. And what they do is, excuse me, they go back to the FDA, they do some clinical trials, and they get it approved for that second indication.
Okay. So it sounds like it's an on-case basis.
Yes, it is.
What do we have to do with this? This is what we've done when we prescribed it had it for something else, but now we have great results that show that it can be used in another way. So then there isn't a rule of thumb. That has to be decided independently.
That's up to the company as to whether they want to do that.
Uh-huh. It
has
to be decided by the FDA.
No, the company decides whether they want to pursue that second
indication. Okay, let's say they do.
Well, then the FDA has to decide whether to approve it.
Uh-huh.
But if the let's assume it gets approved, as they usually do.
Yes.
The company then gets 3 years of what we call market exclusivity. So they're able to market it for that second approval.
I see.
And nobody else can.
Uh-huh.
But even though there's a generic out now, someone could prescribe the generic.
Uh-huh.
And it would get filled even if the patient were going to use it for that other indication.
I see.
It's just a matter of the company marketing it for that. What we often see, however, is the company doing something what we call evergreening, where they come close to the end of their patent on their product, and they will they'll come out with something like a long-acting version of it.
Oh.
And they'll get a patent actually on that long-acting
so
technology, and then they can market it for a long time.
I see. And I just had one other comment.
Sure.
Having listened to what you've been saying, I know that an awful lot of people see these big companies as just terrible, terrible money-grabbing people, but they do have to realize, those other people, that the companies are in competition with each other. And so although they do specialize in certain areas, there's always another company coming along behind or right beside them. And so there is some control over how much something can be marketed at, because there's somebody else who's going to come up with it with a better, newer drug for that particular condition, and they can market it at a lower price if their expenses and so forth allow that. Isn't that something to consider?
That's an excellent point, absolutely. Certainly when a company decides to set its price initially, it doesn't do so in a vacuum.
Right.
It looks at the market, and
yes,
it looks at what other products are out there, what they're competing against, what they're likely to be competing against, and it sets the product at a price they think they can sell the product.
Absolutely. Well, I really value in this country that we have companies that start out small, and they build up, and they learn to do things, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's what we want to encourage.
Absolutely.
And so it seems that sometimes when, say, pharmaceutical companies get big and strong and have a lot of prescriptions, then we say, well, that's not fair because they're taking too much. And the shareholders, of course, have to have some return.
Right.
And so it's much more complex than just looking at a pill and saying it costs this much. It's a whole system. It's a whole system is the word, and a constellation. And you can't just look at one company, one pill, and how much it costs in your town with your insurance or without insurance. You've got to look at the whole ball of wax.
Well, and I think that's what really is done. And you know, when you think about it, it's not just a question of the company and its shareholders. It's a question of how that filters out into the whole financial underpinnings of the United States.
Absolutely.
For example, you might have retirement plans or 401ks.
Right. Good point.
That have a lot of drug stocks.
Absolutely.
And see, things like this are going to be affected. I also want to say I certainly don't want to paint the companies as a bad guy. I mean,
I
shudder to think of.
I'm saying a lot of people do.
Well, yeah, but I know they do, but usually that's because they can't afford their medicines, and they're sick, and they need to be listened to, and they need to be helped. But I think that if you think about all the drugs that are out there, and you think about what is being cured and treated with pharmaceuticals, and then you think about what would happen if we didn't have the drug industry, it would really make you shudder.
Hmm. I need to jump in here. I appreciate the comment of the caller. I have a couple of other people that we need to get to, and we only have about 10 minutes left. I also want to introduce again our guest, Francis Palumbo, who's professor and also executive director of the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy's Center on Drugs and Public Policy, based in Baltimore, Maryland. He is both a licensed pharmacist and also a member of the Maryland Bar, and has practiced both pharmacy and law, and is interested in a number of issues, including pharmacy law and economics, as well as the drug regulation process. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back to off-label prescribing, because this was something that I had thought it might be interesting just to touch on. As you say, and it's my understanding that any physician may prescribe any medication for anything that he or she wants to. So that is really clear, and there certainly is the case where a medicine that has been developed to treat one particular condition, somehow it's discovered that it has benefit in a number of conditions, and I would imagine that physicians that work in particular areas, what they end up doing is sharing information about their experiences with their patients. What moves someone to try something like that in the first place, I don't know. But what you're saying is that the drug companies actually can't. Am I understanding right? Is the drug company can't in any way, cannot, for example, go to a physician and say, you know, we have this medication that's for condition A, but I've been talking with doctors who are using it to treat condition B, and it's working very well for them. The representatives of the drug companies, they cannot do that?
That's correct. They would be violating the law. Mm-hmm. The only thing they can do, there are two things they can do. The first one is they can hand the physician a copy of a peer-reviewed journal article, and it has to be in a peer-reviewed journal, that speaks to the off-label use of that particular medication. It cannot have been produced by the company in any way, but, you know, let's say a researcher at Harvard writes an article or a clinician at Harvard writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it involves their work looking at the unapproved use of a drug. So this is not being done by the company. And it gets published. They can hand that to the physician, and there are certain requirements that they have to put a stamp on it, that there's unapproved use information inside and so forth. They can also give a physician a copy of a reference text, like the textbook of internal medicine, something that the company itself has not produced or had any editorial discretion over, that would contain information on this. But other than that, they cannot do what you said, for example, even talk about it. Mm-hmm. They could just say, doctor, I just want to leave this with you. That's all they can do.
All right. We will continue to take calls here for the next 7 or 8 minutes or so. Going next to a caller in Indiana, Boswell, Indiana. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm on a cell phone, so I'm going to make this short.
Okay.
I'm on the road. I'm a little reluctant to, my daughter's, it feels like there's a big push for this HPV virus vaccine,
mm-hmm.
And I'm a little reluctant. I've got an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, and I'm just kind of caught on whether to let them have that vaccine or not, and after the whole Vioxx thing, I'm just wondering what you think about that. Thanks.
Well, yeah, sure. That certainly is a very highly charged issue right now, especially since some states are trying to require it for young women over 12 years old. I think Texas is the one that comes to mind. You know, there are a couple of things that you have to think about. The first one is that I think what you're thinking about is that it's new, and I'm afraid, you know, to have my children take it because it hasn't proven itself yet. And I think this is a real consideration on the part of people. I mean, if I were in your situation, I would probably think the same way. I mean, if you talk to Dr. Sid Wolf at a health research group in Washington, you know, he'd say he wouldn't give any member of his family a drug until it had been on the market for, I think he said 6 months, but I don't want to quote it out of context here. But the point is that it is new, it is untried, we still don't know, I'm sure, what all the side effects are from this, and now we're going to be giving it to children. And I think this is some cause for concern on the part of parents. On the other hand, you know, if a kid is going to be sexually active, it certainly would at least eliminate the probability that they would end up with cervical cancer from HPV. So, you know, I don't have an answer, except that I realize that there are, you know, competing questions going on here. And at this point, you know, as more time goes on and more people take the vaccine, it becomes a little bit easier to make that decision because, you know, we're not hearing yet of any big problems with it.
All right. I hope that is in part at least an answer. Let's go to...
Just in part, I'm afraid.
Someone who... Well, that may indeed be the best answer one can give at this point. I wasn't intended as a criticism of your response to the caller.
Right, right.
Let's go to Urbana, next in line number 1. Hello.
Hi. About a year ago, one of our local pharmacy companies was taken over by CVS Pharmacy. And when I went over to get my prescription of Lipitor filled, instead of getting it in the usual generic bottle that the pharmacist had filled, I got one that was from the Park Davis Pfizer company and has their label on it. At least I presume it was them. And interestingly enough, it said it was manufactured in Ireland.
Okay.
And the companies make a big deal about not re-importing or not importing medications from other countries, and yet here they're manufacturing it in another country.
Sure.
But the other thing that
I suppose you didn't get it on March 17th, right?
March 17th?
St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, I don't remember. But anyway, the other issue that I was thinking about when I looked at this container, and I've saved it to contemplate, mm-hmm. Is concerns that were raised by an author that has been on WILO radio about people who make drug imposters in this country, including some that where there's no ingredient, no active ingredient in the thing at all, like
right.
special cancer medications. And I think Lipitor, I forget whether Lipitor is one of the targets that they found as being sometimes, what's the word that I want?
Counterfeiting.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, that's something that I, Professor Palumbo is, I know that's one of the things you're really interested in.
Yes.
Well, and it seems to me that if part of what allows the counterfeiting to happen is all the middle people that end up having the drug pass through their hands, there must be profit being made in there in addition to what the drug company is making, which also makes me suspicious about what's going on.
Well, I think you've raised a few issues here. Let me speak to the Ireland issue first, because it's perfectly fine for a pharmaceutical manufacturer in the U.S. to have manufacturing operations outside of the country. In fact, they often do. The Pfizer has a plant in Ireland, apparently, where they make this Lipitor. They have plants all over the world. Those plants have to be approved by our Food and Drug Administration and continually inspected by our Food and Drug Administration. So they have to meet all the good manufacturing practices of any plant that is situated within our borders. So that's a common thing. But Pfizer, in our case, we're talking about Lipitor, controls that whole process all the way along. So it's really no different from whether it was produced in a plant in Connecticut, as far as you should be concerned. So I would not at all be concerned about the integrity of the product from that standpoint. Now, the second issue that you raise is the issue of counterfeiting and all the people who handle products in between and whether the drug companies make even more money. Well, they make less money if it's counterfeit because it's not their product that's getting into your hands. So the drug companies are probably the ones right out there on the front line, more so than the government, to try to prevent the counterfeiting of their own products. Because think about it, every counterfeit Lipitor that gets into the pharmacy didn't get there from Pfizer. So it came from some other place. And the place that's been identified in general is what's called the secondary wholesale distributors. And those are people along the line. They're not the big wholesale distributors McKesson, for example, but they are smaller mom and in some cases mom and pop distributors. There's about 6,000 of them around the United States that are registered with the states, and there are some of those obviously who are a little less scrupulous than others, and are the conduit through which counterfeit drugs enter the market. How do they get them? Well, they get them from the counterfeiters. Sometimes counterfeiters make them, and the products that the counterfeit products they make might have nothing in them. They might have more than they should have of the active ingredient, or they might be right on. They might be just perfect. They sometimes steal them, so they're actually produced by the companies, but they hijack trucks and they steal them and get them into the system themselves. Or they buy them outside Medicaid clinics from patients. So there are a number of ways they get them. The worst for the consumer, of course, is the one that they make and is maybe has nothing in it or actually harmful ingredients in it. And those are the products that you really have to watch out for, because, and especially with certain drugs for cancer, like Procrit, for example, is one for patients who are on chemotherapy. that to the naked eye just looks like water. And so some of the counterfeiters were just filling these things up with tap water and putting a label on them and getting them into the stream of distribution. So the FDA, the manufacturers, the states, everyone is really working hard to try to keep those wolves away from the door. And I have to say, to the United States credit, compared to some other places around the world, we've been pretty good at keeping them away. The things are moving toward what's called a pedigree, and that means that if it comes from anybody other than the company who manufactured it or one of their authorized distributors to the pharmacy, then there's got to be a paper trail that goes along with that product called a pedigree. And the industry is moving very quickly to adopt what's called an electronic pedigree. So they would actually have a little chip in the bottle, and it could be read at various points along the trail. So when it got to the pharmacy, I'm just making this up, but it'd be red light, green light. You know, it's good or it's no good. And to provide even more of a level of safety for the consumer.
We must stop there. I know there are some things that we had hoped to get to that we didn't. There are a lot of issues here, so maybe on another day we might talk again, Professor Palumbo. But for the moment, we want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
Our guest, Francis Palumbo, is professor and executive director at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy's Center on Drugs and Public Policy in Baltimore, Maryland. He is both a licensed pharmacist and member of the Maryland Bar and has practiced both pharmacy and law.